FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Financial Survival Network is brought to you today by Orin Resources, a junior exploration company with the appetite of a major. It's hot on the trail of the next globally significant discovery, creating enormous potential upside for you, the shareholder. Orin is one of the most aggressive exploration companies pursuing high-grade, scalable gold and copper deposits and has a premier seven-project portfolio, including its two flagships, Committee Bay in the Arctic and Sombrero in Peru. Orin's unparalleled technical team and highly experienced management has a history of success in advancing and monetizing exploration assets. No wonder Orin's been called one of the best in the junior exploration sector. Orin trades on the TSX and the NYSE under AUG. To learn more, go to orinresources.com. That's A-U-R-Y-N resources.com.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's 5/13/19. Wow, how did we get here already? What's going on in the world? Gold, if you haven't looked, it's up around $13 the ounce. And, well, it seems like there's a little bit of a tiff going on between China and the U.S. Is it going to continue or will it be peaceably resolved? What is the real story behind the story? I often think we really don't know, but if you've got an idea of what it is, then please feel free to email us at kl@kerrylutz.com. And well, with us today is our good friend. We've known him since we started the podcast, the head of research at Gold Money. I'm talking about Alistair McLeod. Alistair, welcome back. And hey, you wrote an article a couple of days ago, and you seem to be thinking that we truly are, as Friedrich Hayek once said, and wrote a book thusly entitled, On the Road to Serfdom.
Yes. Hello, Kerry. That article is the last in a series of articles where I've been trying to warn people that the expansionary phase of the credit cycle is now at an end or coming to an end, may indeed have come to an end. And so we're going to run towards the crisis. And on top of that, I think the situation has been made doubly interesting and worse, if you like, by the rise of trade protectionism. And in essence, what I have been doing is comparing the current situation to the situation in 1929 to 1932, when obviously the stock market fell very, very heavily. It's that combination of protectionism and the end of the monetary expansion phase, which really fueled the Roaring Twenties. When those two things come together, the overall effect can be disastrous. We hope it doesn't happen this time. But the point about the article you referred to was, let us assume that the situation deteriorates, as I have suggested, then what happens to politics? And you've got basically two political models on the table at the moment. There is our political model, which is democratic. It's a welfare state. And our democracy basically continues to vote for more and more money spent on welfare. The second model is the one which is a mercantile control model, as it were, from Russia and China. And there, the story is very different from here. If you happen to be a national in those two countries, then you are told, don't interfere with politics. You have got no political rights whatsoever. But in return for that, we will let you work and keep most of what you earn, most of the wealth that you make, and we will encourage you to get rich if you put the effort into it. Those are the two models, and it's a question really, what will survive best through a credit crisis of the sort which hit the world in 1929 to 1932.
Interesting. So basically, they just tell you there, just shut up and make money and don't say anything or else, or you'll suffer the consequences and they will be severe. Or you kind of, we're really heading towards, you can't, in the West, you're not allowed to make money and you're not going to be allowed to voice your opposition either. You see that in the UK. You see it with these huge social media platforms, Facebook, Google, Amazon, where they can, for the time being at least, legally restrict speech, and there's not a thing that you can do about it.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I think that model is likely to change. I'm sure, like a lot of your listeners, I've read George Gilder's account of life after Google. And the basic point he makes is that the model of giving something for free, in inverted commas, in return for which you give free use to Google or Facebook or whatever of your data, so they earn money on the back of your data, that is something which is coming to an end. It naturally comes to an end because the politicians begin to tax it, they begin to understand how to control it, and then another model free market model, if you like, has to evolve. And we don't know quite at this stage what that's likely to be, but I think the world after Google is going to be quite a bit different. And when it comes to our democracy, that has been exposed as a sham, really, by the whole of the Brexit process. A referendum was held. The politicians who agreed to hold the referendum basically did not want the result, a vote for Brexit, but they said they would honour it. And now they're backtracking furiously. Mind you, the law is that they have to honour it because the legislation has been passed for us to leave. The only question, the only open question, is at what date we leave. So if we can't get an agreement out of the European Union, then we just leave. Might be more complicated than I've suggested, but that basically is the truth in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tend to agree with you for sure. And there seems to be a backlash going now that the people have realized that they're going to deny the will of the voters. And it seems like the pro-Brexit branch or the pro-Brexit group is getting restless. And, well, death of the Conservative Party seems to be the demise is right around the corner here, huh?
Well, so long as they've got Mrs. May as a leader, then they're dead in the water. It's as simple as that. Yeah. I mean, Nigel Farage has been, I think, extremely sensible. He doesn't talk about trade. He talks about democracy. And of course, democracy is something which we all hold dear in our hearts. And when our politicians fail to deliver, we have the opportunity to chuck them out. And that basically is what Nigel Farage is exploiting. And I think he's been very shrewd over it, I must say.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he's one smart guy, isn't he?
Yes, a lot smarter than the establishment would like to believe.
Yeah, well, I firmly believe that if it wasn't for Nigel Farage coaching Trump in the second debate, Trump very well might not be president now.
That's a very interesting point, because I think that's a two-way street. I think he has learned an awful lot of the art of politics, if you like. Through his contacts with not only President Trump, but also his election team, who delivered such a stunning result. And I think that, you know, the messages from that are something that Nigel Farage has taken on board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. And probably without Trump, Brexit wouldn't have passed either, would it have?
I'm not too sure, because the sequence of events was we voted in a referendum for Brexit before Trump was elected. Mm-hmm. Now, in this country, almost nobody, and this is still true to a large extent, nobody supported Trump. They don't have a vote, but the thought of Trump being elected to most people in this country was an anathema. he was elected. That is an American electorate's decision. It's got nothing to do with us or anyone else. Yet, you know, President Trump is meant to be coming here. I think it's in July for you know, celebrations to do with the last war. You know, the Speaker of the House will not permit him to speak in the Commons. Now, this is a you know, if you like, something that is politely offered to visiting U.S. presidents every time they come. They can, you know, go to the House of Commons, they make a speech, and it's all very nice and so on and so forth. The Speaker is saying, no, I'm not going to permit that. I'm not going to allow that. Now, this to me is just, if you like, it's indicative of the anathema the establishment here holds about Trump. And yet Nigel Farage understands the appeal of Trump to the people. And this was something which the Democrats over there failed to understand.
They don't get it.
Yeah, and everybody here is exactly the same. Now, having said that, when I watched the election and I saw what I really sort of read as arrogance in the Democratic camp, I just sort of thought, well, you know, I don't think they deserve to get it. And sure enough, they didn't. I mean, there was an arrogance. We have a right, effectively. Yeah. You know, and Hillary Clinton was you know, pushing the woman's lib thing, and I was thinking, no, that's a mistake. That is a mistake, because you're immediately what you're doing, you're telling the men, we don't care about you. This is a women's world. You're not going to. I mean, by alienating voters with that message, you get absolutely nowhere. So it was, to my mind, it was quite obvious that Donald Trump had found the gap. And he was going for it, and he got it. And in this country, I think that's what Nigel Farage is doing when it comes to the European elections. Now, at the moment, he's talking about bringing democracy back into Westminster as well, and trying to get the movement into Westminster with electing MPs. Now, that at the moment, I think, is probably just a bridge too far. And I think he's more likely to really do extremely well in those European elections. We just have to see what happens after that. Because I have little doubt in my own mind that at some stage, Theresa May will go. And I think she will probably go fairly soon.
Really?
If I'm right in that, then the most likely replacement would be Boris Johnson. It's a two-stage process. So, you know, I can't say with certainty. I can't say that, you know, odds-on favourite, he's going to get it. No, but if he does get it, then Boris actually does understand free markets. And he does understand that the law that has already been passed by the House of Commons is that we leave. Right. And I suspect he will just, you know, he will talk to the EU, but basically he will let that leave with, on WTO terms, he will take that route and negotiate everything later.
Really? So a hard Brexit, you're saying? A hard Brexit, huh?
Absolutely.
Wow. Well,
we haven't, I mean, there is no alternative, Kerry. I mean, you know, we can go and talk to Monsieur Barnier and all the rest of it.
I don't know what they're doing with that stuff. Why are they talking? I say, I don't quite get what it is they think they're going to negotiate here, this exit. So they're still going to be a member with all the, with none of the benefits and all of the burdens. And it just doesn't seem to me like the people of the UK are really going to put up with that.
You're right. It doesn't make any sense. And not you know, and not only that, but we have no say over trade arrangements that may well be forced upon us from the EU. I mean, it's ridiculous. It becomes taxation without representation.
Hey, well, we're specialists at that here in the U.S. We know all about that. We were complaining about a 10% tax on tea, you know, and now we've got these taxes. They basically take anything that's not bolted down that you can't hide, that you can't put under your mattress or into a safe, is fair game for the authorities here. And I feel like it's like that most of the world, Alistair.
Yes, I think that's right. I must apologize that we created the precedent on the tea tax.
Well, hey, you know, you're as responsible for that personally as you are for slavery and ending slavery. I mean, come on. It's like a long time ago, And we're past that. But you know, these old beefs, especially in today's modern Democratic Party here in the United States, the old tribal differences just never can be put aside because there's so much to gain by keeping them alive and going. We're in this mad politics.
It's really about, you know, if you have got a constituency of people who support that sort of thing, you stir them up, basically.
Mm-hmm. Stir them up and turn them, you know, divide and conquer. And, you know, here in the U.S., Alistair, if you show me a failing city, I will show you a city that has one party, almost all government rule for 30 to 100 years. In Chicago, the last Republican mayor went out when Al Capone went to prison. And I'm not saying Republicans are good by any stretch. They're just as corrupt as the Democrats. But the point is, where there's no competition and where one party is able to exact its will without any accountability whatsoever, it's a recipe for disaster.
It is, and I'd confirm that we have evidence of exactly the same syndrome in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a human phenomena. If there isn't multiple parties fighting for that gold ring, you know, trying to jump off the merry-go-round and grab the gold ring, then you get stagnation, you get unchecked corruption, and you wind up with collapse. So that seems to be a fallacy of so-called democratic republics here, of how you ensure that one party doesn't become or exercise hegemony over the others. And I think that's a really difficult thing, because eventually the party that's got its hands on the levers of governmental power is going to use that power to effectively advance their own interests. And that's what we've seen here.
Yes, of that, I think there can be little doubt.
Yeah, so we're in a fix here. What do you think can happen that can change the situation, turn things around, and make it not happen? And I'm not saying the likelihood of it or anything else, but what can the people do?
Well, the people, I think, are not in control of the situation, and I think there's very little they can do. The answer to the problems that we face is to stop government printing money at will to finance its deficits. We have to return to sound money, and sound money basically means backing the currency with gold to the extent that no more currency or credit can be issued without it being backed by yet more gold. And this, I think, is where Russia is going. Have been accumulating gold quite rapidly. I believe that China has reserves, the undeclared physical gold reserves, to do so as well. We haven't. We have the problem that our welfare states do depend for its financing on the continued expansion of money and credit. If you stop that, then the mandated cost of the welfare state just cannot be satisfied. So, you know, if we were to return to sound money in the West, we would have to introduce new laws cancelling current laws about welfare entitlements. And I cannot see any politician in the West doing that.
Yeah. So we're just waiting for the collapse and hoping for the best, because we just don't have the political will to solve the problems. I mean, look, they did it, and they've done it in other places. You look at Chile, their retirement system, it's kind of the envy of the world, although don't talk to any leftist or collectivist about it, because they don't even know it exists. But Chile's done it. If they could do it, why can't other countries? Do we have to get that close to the precipice before anything can be done?
I think the point about Chile is that under Allende, it went over the precipice. Mm-hmm. So they have seen the downside. This is also true in Russia. Yes. It could have been true in China if things had gone slightly differently after Mao's death, and if Deng had followed a different route. But basically, once you've been over the precipice, you've wiped out your currency, you've basically wiped out your economy, and you start again. What you need is someone with the wisdom to understand that you mustn't do it again. So under any circumstances, and that is what happened in Chile. And I think that's a very, very important point. You know, when you had the disaster, what comes out of it isn't necessarily an immediate phoenix rising from the ashes. I mean, look at what happened with Germany. World War One, a catastrophe for Germany, and that was followed by a monetary collapse. That gave the rise to fascism. Fascism wasn't defeated until the end of World War II. So, you know, it's part of a process which could actually continue after a currency collapse. You need the right people to come in after a currency collapse for the nation to, to rebuild itself and to coexist with other nations.
And this is the argument of the left. Socialism never works because we could just never get the right person in there. But now AOC, man, she knows what she's doing. And Elizabeth Warren, she is just great. They all know how to fix this problem. But the reality is no. So for democracy, democratic republics to work, you really do need the right people. And I'm beginning to think that maybe those right people just don't exist, Alistair.
Well, we certainly don't see them today. And this is why in that last article, which I wrote, which you kindly referred to, I was looking at the difference, if you like, between the Russia and China model and the Western model. And I have to say that probably the best outcome for us is to move towards the Chinese and Russian model for future economies rather than what we have at the moment, because what we have at the moment, I think, could well be, collapse of currency, collapse of economy, widespread impoverishment. The next leader, if you like, in accordance with Hayek's road to serfdom, we find is someone that we would never, ever wish to lead us.
Yeah. Well, you know, just when you think it can't get any worse, it gets worse, right? I mean, we've seen this, yes. Just when you thought it was safe to go outside.
Yeah, exactly. Don't rule it out that when it's really bad, it might just get worse. Don't rule it out.
Mm-hmm. Yep. This is true. Very, very true. Well, hey, I don't know what's going to happen here, but these are exciting times at the same time as our ability to govern ourselves seems to be diminishing or maybe even collapsing. We see these great advances in so many other things, which also are double-edged swords. I'm talking technology, you know, all of these things that humanity gets to do that, you know, 400 or 500 years ago, a serf on the land, all the serf did every day was the same, pretty much, with the exception of the seasons and harvest festivals and such things. But every other day was pretty much just like the one before it. The people you saw, your activities, and it was a very dreary, dull place to be. Well, I don't know exactly. I don't know exactly where we're heading, but it certainly is great cause for concern. If you're into it, watch some of those so-called prophets on YouTube who foresaw the rise of Donald Trump and believes he's going to just save everyone from everything. They're quite comical. They should only be true, but I really don't have any great confidence in them, Alistair. Anyways, hey, find Alistair's work over at goldmoney.com. Check out his latest article about the road to serfdom. We're certainly on it. Check us out, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Twitter feed at Kerry Lutz. Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. Alistair, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on.
That was very much my pleasure, Kerry. Thank you.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.